3 days later, Robert went out to the franchise to drive the Sharps over to Norton for the assizes. "It will be months before I can look at a telephone without blenching," he admitted to Marion. "Did you take turnabout?" she asked. "Oh, no. We each had our own. Kevin and his clerk at his chambers. Me at his flat in St. Paul's Churchyard. Alec Ramsden at his office. And three of his men. Wherever they could find a telephone, they could use uninterruptedly. I must say, the Danish tourist office was a godsend. They poured information at us. Kevin, his clerk, and I took exports, and Ramsden and his men took imports. From then on, it was a tedious business of being put through to managers and asking, 'Have you a man called Bernard Chadwick working for you?' I was so sick of the telephone that when it rang at my end, I nearly didn't pick it up."
"And it was Ramsden?"
"Yes. He said, 'We've got him. Bernard Chadwick buys porcelain and stuff for Bray, Havard and Company.' After that, it was a rush to interview the people we needed."
"Well," Marion said, "if anyone had told me last week that I should be leaving the franchise to go to a triumph at Norton Assizes, I wouldn't have believed it. Poor Stanley can sleep in his own bed from now on, instead of guarding us."
"Isn't he sleeping at the franchise tonight?" Robert asked.
"No. Why should he?"
"I don't know. I don't like the idea of the house being left empty. Couldn't he stay here one more night until the case is over?" "If they want to wreck our windows again," Mrs. Sharp said, "I don't suppose Stanley's being here will deter them."
"No, I suppose not.
But before having dinner with Kevin at the Feathers in Norton, Robert called the police station at Milford and reminded them that the Sharps' house would be empty for the night. It was late before he went to bed, and he fell asleep as soon as his head touched the pillow. The telephone had been ringing for some moments before he became aware of it.
"Well,"
he muttered, and became instantly wide awake. It was Stanley, who had decided to stay at the franchise anyway. Could he come back to Milford? The franchise was on fire. He made the 20 miles in a time that the Robert Blair of a month ago would have considered inconceivable. He saw the glow against the horizon like the rising of a full moon. The gates were wide open, and the courtyard, bright in the flames, was crowded with men and machines. Mattresses and bed linen were piled on the grass. Furniture stood about looking surprised and lost. Then two things happened together. The first floor fell in with a crash, and as fresh flames lit the surrounding faces, Robert saw two youths wearing gloating expressions. Stanley had seen them too, and the next moment Robert saw Stanley's fist catch the father one under the chin, and the gloating face disappeared into the darkness. Robert hadn't hit anyone since he left school, but his left arm seemed to do all that was necessary of its own accord, and the second gloating face went down into obscurity. At that moment, the roof began to crumple, and the little round attic window, so infamous, sank slowly inwards. Then the whole roof collapsed. When at last the fire died away, only the walls stood, blurred and grimy, in the middle of the trampled grass. Next morning, at Norton Assizes, it seemed that half Milford had managed to squeeze itself into the court. The packed room fidgeted uneasily through most of prosecuting counsel's account of the crime. Miles Allison was the antithesis of Kevin McDermott. Then there was a sudden stir, and Betty Kane was taking the oath, and all was stillness. The tilted back brim of her hat still showed the childish forehead, and Robert, who now knew all about her life in the week she was missing, found himself being surprised all over again at sight of her. Once again she gave her evidence in model fashion. The only difference this time was that the bench wasn't doting. Indeed, if one was to judge by the expression on the face of Mr. Justice Say, it was very far from doting. Robert wondered how much the judge's critical gaze was due to the conclusion that Kevin McDermott would not be sitting there ready to defend the two women in the dock unless they had a thundering good defense. It was in a charged atmosphere that Kevin rose to cross-examine.
"Miss Kane," he began in his gentlest drawl, "you say that it was dark when you arrived at the franchise."
"Yes."
"Too dark to see the outside of the house?"
"Yes."
"The night you escaped,
Perhaps that wasn't quite dark. Oh, yes. That was even darker, if possible. So that you could not possibly have seen the outside of the house on any occasion. Never.
Never. Well, let us consider what you say you could see from the window of your prison in the attic. You said in your statement to the police, when you were describing this unknown place where you were imprisoned, that the carriageway went straight for a little and then divided in two into a circle up to the door. How did you know it did that?
I could see it.
From where?
From the window in the attic.
But from the window in the attic, it's possible to see only the straight part of the carriageway. The edge of the roof cuts off the rest. How did you know that the carriageway divided in two and made a circle up to the door?
I saw it.
How?
From that window, the way I described.
Certainly, it is the way you described. But what you described was the view of the courtyard as seen by, let us say, someone looking over the wall at it, not by someone looking at it from the window in the attic.
I take it, said Mr. Justice Say, that you have a witness to the extent of the view from the window.
Two, my lord.
One with normal vision will be sufficient, said the court dryly.
Kevin resumed his cross-examination.
Have you ever been abroad, Miss Kane?
Abroad?
She was surprised by the change of subject.
No.
You have not, for instance, been to Denmark lately, to Copenhagen?
No.
There was no change in her expression.
Do you know a man called Bernard Chadwick?
No.
The tone was colourless. But she was suddenly wary, and Robert was reminded of the subtle change in an animal that has been relaxed and becomes attentive. You did not, for instance, stay with him at an hotel in Copenhagen?
No.
So that if I were to suggest that you spent those missing weeks in an hotel in Copenhagen and not in an attic at the franchise, I would be mistaken.
Quite mistaken.
Thank you. Miles Allison, as Kevin had anticipated, rose to retrieve the situation. Miss Kane, you arrived at the franchise by car.
Yes.
And that car, you say in your statement, was driven up to the door of the house. Now, if it was dark, as you say, there must have been lights on the car which would illuminate not only the carriageway, but most of the courtyard.
Yes,
she broke in, before he could even put it to her.
Of course, I must have seen it then. I knew I had seen it. I knew it.
She glanced at Kevin for a moment, and Robert was reminded of her face when she saw that she had guessed correctly about the suitcases that first day at the franchise. She was succeeded in the witness box by Rose Glynn. Kevin, cross-examining, merely suggested that she had in fact been dismissed from the franchise and had not given in her notice at all. Then he let her go. He was waiting for her poor stooge, Clarice Reese. The stooge, when she arrived, looked even less happy than she had looked in the police court at Milford. Robert saw Kevin's considering eye on her. He was deciding on his approach. She had been scared stiff by Miles Allison, in spite of his patient quietness, evidently regarding anything in a wig and gown as hostile, so Kevin became her wooer and protector, and Gladys Reese began to relax. Here, she felt, as she listened to his caressing voice, was a friend.
"Now, Gladys," Kevin began, "I'm going to suggest that you didn't want to come here today and give evidence against these two people at the franchise."
"No, I didn't."
"But you came," he said.
"Yes."
"Why? Because you thought it was your duty?"
"No. Oh, no."
"Was it because someone forced you to come, someone who said, 'You say what I tell you to say, or I'll tell about you'?"
She looked bewildered.
"Because if anyone made you tell lies by threatening you, they can be punished for it."
This was clearly a new idea to her.
"You see, Gladys, his lordship would deal very sternly with anyone who had used threats to make you come here and say something that wasn't true. Do you understand that?"
"Yes,"
she said in a whisper. Now, I'm going to suggest to you what really happened. Someone, a friend of yours perhaps, took something from the franchise. Let us say, a watch. She didn't want the watch herself, and so she handed it on to you. Your friend is perhaps a domineering person, and you didn't like to refuse her gift. So you took it. Now, I suggest that presently that friend proposed to you that you should back up a story she was going to tell in court, that she had told you she'd heard screaming at the franchise, and you said no, and that she then said, if you don't back me up, I shall say that you took that watch from the franchise one day when you came to see me, or some other threat of that sort. He paused, but she merely looked puzzled. Now, I suggest that because of those threats, you did actually go to a police court and did actually back up your friend's untrue story, but that when you got home, you were sorry and ashamed, and that you then wrapped up the watch and sent it back to the franchise by post with a note saying, I don't want none of it. I suggest, Gladys, that that is what really happened. But Gladys had had time to take fright.
No, she said, no, I never had that watch.
I am quite wrong about that.
Yes.
Kevin picked up a sheet of paper. When you were at school, you were very good at drawing.
Yes.
Well, I have here a map of Canada, which you did at school. The map was taken across the court to her. You made that map yourself?
Yes.
And you wrote your name in the corner?
Yes.
And printed Dominion of Canada across the bottom?
Yes.
Good. Now, I have here the scrap of paper on which someone wrote the words, I don't want none of it. This was enclosed with a watch that was sent back to the franchise, the watch that had gone missing while your friend Rose Glynn was working there. Now, I suggest that the printing of I don't want none of it is the same as the printing of Dominion of Canada, that it was written by the same hand, and that that hand was yours. When a handwriting expert gave evidence next that the samples of printing were by the same hand, it was obvious that the jury had already made up their minds for themselves on this. No one who saw the two samples could doubt it. Allison's suggestion that experts could be wrong was automatic and half-hearted, and anyway was demolished by Kevin's fingerprint witness, who deposed that the same fingerprints were to be found on each. Kevin was now free to deal with Betty Kane.